Hi everyone, it's Frankie here. Before we get into the episode, I wanted to give you a little update about what's going on with Red and Buried. And this is a big one. Sarah is no longer going to be on Red and Buried. Her real life outside of the podcast has gotten extremely busy. So we've decided that I'll carry on with it solo for the time being. I'm afraid it was a boringly amicable decision. Sorry, drama fans. And who knows? Maybe we'll dig her up from time to time in the future. Ha! That made it sound like she's no longer with us. I can assure you that Sarah is very much alive and well, and I certainly haven't buried her anywhere yet. The podcast itself isn't going to change in terms of format or anything like that. The bad news is it'll just be me hosting. But the good news is I already have so many amazing authors lined up for this year. So I really hope you'll keep hanging out with me in the literary graveyard. The episode you're about to hear was recorded last year with Sarah. So this one is for Sarah, who I will stress again is very much alive and well. Enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Red and Buried Podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Frankie.
And today we have the fantastic Leonie Swan with us.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
You were just telling us before we started recording that you've just finished a manuscript.
Yes, literally today.
Sent it off.
Yeah, very exciting. Type the last word today, send off the thing tomorrow, and then we'll see what my editor says. Yeah, exciting times.
Very exciting.
I feel bad that you're stuck talking to us tonight, Nat. I feel like you should be off.
No, it's great. I need a bit of time to unwind anyway, so I wouldn't go straight out partying and more like milling around the house looking for things to tidy and clean. So I much prefer being here with you guys.
Oh, that's something.
Thank you.
Well, I want to ask loads of questions about all of that, but I think I have a little bio I'm going to read out about you.
Yes.
And I'm going to apologize in advance for any of the German words that I get horribly wrong. And
German words.
Oh, it's my pesky, stupid brain, unfortunately. But I will do my best. We have just looked up the pronunciation of a couple of things, so I should be okay.
Right. Looking forward to it.
And equally, I've taken all of these things off the internet and hopefully they're all accurate. And please feel free to correct me if they're not. But hopefully.
Okay.
Let's give it a go. Right. So Leonie Swan is the nom de plume of a German crime writer. Of a German. Oh, my God. Great start, Frankie. The English words I got wrong.
The easiest English word. A.
No, because it was a slightly stilted sentence that I. That's my fault. So I should have. That's my bad. Right. I'm going to start that again. Leonie Swan is the nom de plume of a German crime writer. She studied philosophy, psychology, and English literature in Munich. That's quite interesting. Her first novel, Three Bags Full, in which a flock of sheep try to solve the murder of their beloved shepherd, sold over 100,000 copies in the first 6 months after publication and has been translated into 32 languages. Her latest book, The Sunset Years of Agnes Sharp, has been described as the unmissable cozy crime sensation for fans of Richard Osman. One murder to solve and another to cover up. It'll be tricky, but the OAP residents of Sunset Hall are going to give it their best shot. Sunset Hall is a house share for the old and unruly, led by Agnes Sharp. It's an eventful day when this group of idiosyncratic seniors gets a visit from the police to inform them of some shocking news. A body has been discovered next door. Everyone puts on a long face, but they are secretly relieved the body in question is not the one they're currently hiding in the shed. Sorry about that, Lilith. It seems the answer to their little problem with Lilith may have fallen right into their laps. All they have to do is find out who murdered their neighbour so they can pin Lilith's death on them, thus killing two old birds with one stone. To investigate, the group, not forgetting Hetty the tortoise, will venture into the not-so-idyllic village of Duckend and tangle with sinister bankers, broken stairlifts, inept criminals, and their own dark secrets. Outside of writing, Leonie lives in Berlin, where she writes, walks dogs, and drinks tea, not necessarily in that order. As well as being gifted with a unique imagination and talent for writing, she's also an exceptionally gifted nature photographer and an all-round lovely person.
Gosh, it's almost all true. I live in near Cambridge at the moment,
oh,
so I have moved to England. So it's a slight detail. It's a bit, but I used to live in Berlin, so that was correct at the time. But I'm guessing somebody hasn't updated the information. So I'm now based near Cambridge.
Oh, that makes things
in
easier.
English countryside.
The time zones and,
yes,
and, things.
And yeah, apart from that, it's all true.
Great. Well, that's not too bad. And once we take out the awful pronunciation of things, we got there. Fantastic.
Well done.
Thank you. So Sarah's a little bit triggered by this because a few weeks ago we had the lovely Ian Moore on our podcast and his book is set in France and poor Sarah had to...
Oh gosh, yeah.
A lot of French.
I mean, I massacred the French language. It was almost impressive.
Yes. I imagine they're burning an effigy of you there as we speak.
Yeah, definitely. Anyway, moving on.
I'm sure you find something else to mispronounce this session.
Oh, 100%. It's a talent at this point. What can I say?
I think people will be disappointed if you don't at this point. I think it's a little treat. But I'm holding a beautiful copy of your beautiful book. I have to say, not to judge a book by its cover, but my God, the spreading is gorgeous.
I know, it's gorgeous, isn't it? I mean, the whole thing is just... I've never had the spread thing before. I mean, I wasn't even know where it was a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, this is the first time I've seen, the first time I had it in one of my books because I, you know, I had quite a lot of translation. There's all kinds of things they do with books.
Yeah.
I had a little fluffy bit of wool stuck to one. I think it was an Italian copy. But this is my very first experience with spreadsheets, so I'm thrilled. Yeah, I think it's really beautiful.
Yeah, nicely Hetty represented on the side there.
Yes.
Very cute. And they, sorry, do you see they put a bit of wool? Was that for three bags full? So
yes, that was for three bags full. I think the Italians did that. Oh. It's a really, very, very plain white cover, and you've got a bit of fluff there, and you've got basically a stylized sheep with just the head and four legs sticking out.
That's so cute.
Very cute. Yeah, I know. Not super practical on a bookshelf, because, you know, it needs this extra room.
Yeah.
But definitely very cute, yeah.
Amazing.
But I love a book cover. I know you shouldn't judge, I mean, but...
I think everybody judges, I mean, to a point, let's be completely honest. If you're in a bookshop, you're completely overwhelmed. There's all kinds of things. Yeah. I mean, unless you know an author and say, I want to read something by... but if you're just sort of browsing, of course you're attracted to a nice cover. I mean, it's like,
That's no
point in beating around the bush, I believe.
No.
Right. So I'm really happy that this one came out so well.
So good.
I know, but what are you going to do for the next book now? You've got to beat wool and a beautiful spread. How do you go?
And it's not my problem, really.
That's
it's
true.
My publisher is, so to be, who knows?
They've got a job on their hands.
Yeah. But we could combine the two. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
Woolly pages all around the edge. Yeah.
Is it a book or something else?
Printed on wool or something. But let's talk a bit more about your wonderful book, which is, I mean, so unusual and fun and amazing characters. Really, really enjoyed it.
I'm glad you feel that. It's exactly what it's supposed to be. Fun is something really, really central for me. I mean, it's not everything, obviously. You need character, you need depth of character, and you need suspense and all that. But for me, if there isn't sort of enjoyment in it, if isn't there sort of bits of your fun and things you laugh at that surprise you, then it's not my thing. Obviously, there's a lot of great books out there who somehow cope without humor, but for me, it's just what I want to do. I want to sort of, you know, give people a good time.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's really important to me.
Well, you've definitely succeeded. And I think... It's something actually, I think that it's a really nice trend we're seeing now. Not a trend is the wrong word, but an emergence, I would say, of the more lighter side of crime. Cozy crime, it feels like, is having a real resurgence right now, which is amazing. I think it's a really accessible way for people to get into the crime genre because it's not super serious. There is a lovely lightness to it. And it's life is funny and funny, weird things happen. So
and death is funny
death
too.
Is funny too. And getting old is funny too, you know?
Yeah. Not only, but also, yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's a perfect combination. If you've got suspense on the one, you've got comic relief on the other, and they both enhance each other. If you've got this really tense situation and afterwards you've got something to laugh about, it's just sort of, it helps you to basically regroup. And at the same time, I think this tension you had before also makes the funny thing funnier. So for me, it's really a marriage made in heaven of two things that really enhance and sort of help each other along. So yeah. Works for me.
Ditto. Also, it's kind of what we need at the moment. Let's face it, everything's a bit crap, isn't it?
Yeah, so. True.
Yes.
It's nice to have some
And
light
I feel
heart.
That it doesn't mean that you're not sort of you can't tackle more serious subjects. Mm-hmm. It's not like sort of what was very important to me, because I write about older people and I haven't quite reached that age yet. So I was very wary of being patronizing or, you know, stereotypical or just of doing cliches. So I really wanted to avoid the feeling that I'm making fun of people. Yeah. Mm. I mean, you're supposed to laugh with them, and you were supposed to laugh at these absolutely hilarious and absurd situations they get themselves into. Yes. But I was quite wary of me, having any situation where they come across as, you know, just somebody, something to be made fun of. Mm. So that was very important to me, and I tried to steer clear of that. So.
Yeah, no, I definitely don't think it is in any way mean spirited. It's very much as you say, you're in on the joke with them.
Yes. Mm. Mm. That's what I was hoping to achieve.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as well, it's, you know, there are kind of serious elements to it, like you say. And obviously, you know, dementia and things isn't typically funny.
Yes.
But
not a picnic.
No, not usually. But you have to also, I think how everybody gets through life is laughing at the awful things that happen. So,
and in a way, the grimmer things get, the more you sort of need to preserve your sense of humour.
Oh my God.
And I think it's really important for the reader as well, because I mean, I can sort of, if I observe myself as a reader, if I read something that is just too tense all the time, at some point I switch off because I can't take it anymore. And having these sort of bits of humor built in, these bits of tension relief, really makes me sort of go along with it a lot easier, because it keeps me going as a reader.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping it'll happen for other readers who read my stuff as well.
Definitely. We had Nikki French on a little while ago, and I always think of this. They said that sometimes in a crime book, it feels like the character knows they're in a crime book because it's so serious, it's so heavy, and it's like unrealistically thick with kind of ennui. But that's not life. You know, even in the most serious moments, like you say, there is someone will say a stupidly inappropriate comment or make a silly joke, and it's necessary.
Yes.
For survival.
Or something absurd happens that you sort of didn't see coming. And at least that's my experience of life. No matter how strange the situation, there will always be something cropping up that you didn't expect. And a lot of humor really comes from being surprised in a way. So if it's something you just didn't expect in that situation, everything's terribly serious, and then somebody else comes in and with a completely different concept, and then things clash, and then you laugh because you're surprised, and at the same time you got, you know, more complexity happening. It's for me also a lot about things not being one track.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So Sunset Hill is like the best place in the world to live, I think.
I'd move in if I've reached a certain age. Yeah. So it definitely seems like a very attractive place to be, because you've got this bunch of very, very eccentric characters, yes, but they really care for each other. They look out for each other.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of friction, obviously, because if you put a bunch of older people together and they all got very strong views on things, there will be friction, but there's genuine care and there's genuine looking out for each other. And at the same time, they sort of challenge each other all the time. So for me, I suppose in a way, the book was a bit of a fantasy of how things could be if you get old, and how I would hope things might be if, you know, so if you reach a certain age. So in a way, it's a sort of utopia for the age, with the odd murder thrown in for good measure, obviously.
Yeah.
I wouldn't aim for a body count for my own sunset years, but
you never know.
I suppose the older you get, the more relaxed you get about it, because you realize that at some point, sooner or later, I mean, death doesn't becomes less abstract, I suppose.
Yeah.
So maybe you're a bit more relaxed about it, so at least my characters in the book certainly are. They don't have the your typical approach to death and to murder.
No.
Probably because they've got a bit of a background as well, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would really love to have a dog like Brexit as well.
Oh, I have a dog, but it's not like Brexit.
No.
The only good Brexit.
I was going to say. The only acceptable form of Brexit, I will take.
The best Brexit ever.
Seriously.
Sorry about for this subject.
No.
We very much agree.
Yes, very much.
So tell us a little bit about your writing process. One thing we always like to ask authors who come on is what you enjoy most and least about the writing process.
Well, in a way, I suppose I like the whole thing. I really like getting started on something because then you, basically the world's your oyster. You can do whatever you want. I go in and start. I might have a rough idea of what I want to achieve. I mean, in this case, I had this concept of having the most inappropriate people investigate a murder. These really quite challenged elderly folks. So that was the basic idea, and the idea that they might be hiding something themselves. But that's all I had, really. So I don't do extensive research in advance. And I just sat down and sort of started writing something. And it, in this case, was really the first scene, more or less the way we find it in the book. And then by writing about characters, I get to know them better. So it's a bit like meeting people in real life. Yeah. So you might meet them on a train, you have a little chat, and you know a little bit to get an impression. And then, I don't know, another day you might see them, at work. And then it's different because it's a different situation. You get all these little pieces and they, you know, little by little form a character and form your impression of that person. And that's exactly the way it works for me writing a book. You sort of had little pieces of Agnes and her gang and it just sort of got denser and more complex as I go along. I usually don't have a very clear idea of who the murderer might be. I have my murders first. I've got a dead body and I'm just as puzzled as everyone else because I have no idea who did it. And then, and that can actually take quite a while until I have my epiphany and sort of decide. I mean, it's a mix of decision and of just sort of seeing it all of a sudden. It was there all along, but I didn't know. And then, so in a way, I'm sort of my first reader. And it can take quite a while. And then this moment of, I know who did it. This is also a really good moment that I really enjoy in writing.
I bet. Agatha Christie used to do that, didn't she, as well? She'd get at the end and then go back and tweak it if need be.
Yes, you can always go back and polish and make it all look like you planned it long in advance and make it look perfect. But I think in a way, if you don't know, you have all these sort of different sort of ideas and leads, and it helps me to have more convincing red herrings, because at the time I wrote about it, there might not have been a red herring. It might have been the actual thing.
Yeah.
So that sort of makes it more convincing, I suppose, for me at least, and hopefully at some point for the reader. Sometimes it can be quite late. So the book I just finished, which, by the way, is the last or the third installment of Agnes Sharp.
Ooh.
So it'll be two more Agnes Sharp adventures.
Amazing.
I just finished the third one. And up to 2 months ago, I didn't know who did it, which was starting to get a bit worrying because I was 2 months before deadline. And I had ideas, but it wasn't quite there yet. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like your subconscious knew all along. And all of a sudden you see it, and that is a really good moment, one of my favorites. I also like at the very end, just look, having the final text, the first draft or second draft, and then just going in, getting all the details right, doing the polishing, just making sure all the words seem smooth and in the right place. So yeah, loads of fun stuff. I'm trying to think of anything I do not enjoy. Well, sometimes you have on an idea of where you want to get to. I very much think of writing as a journey, and I've got landmarks, so places I want to be at a certain point. Like, I don't know, there will be this party, and on this party something's going to happen, and I know that. And I don't know how to get to the bloody party. So that might be a moment when I feel like I don't see the way there yet. And that can be obviously a bit of a draggy moment. I sit there and I need to get there and I don't know how. And so it's not like everything's enjoyable, but I'd say 90% of it is fun. So yeah, lucky me.
That's good. Yeah, you're obviously doing the right job.
Yeah.
Have you ever got to the end and kind of finished, then gone back and gone, oh my God, I really missed something when I wrote that bit before I knew who did it?
You mean in terms of chronology or... that happens, but you sort of, it's fairly easy to... smooth out. I mean, so especially if you move bits around and then you might have something in a bit of text that doesn't belong there anymore. But it's I haven't had it in, you know, the big things. I haven't sort of decided last minute that this character is just completely wrong. Probably because I very much feel that I don't really make them up as such. I tell a story that is there on a certain level or plane of reality. Yeah. It's not that I just sort of have complete flexibility and can move everything around at will. Yeah. I mean, I could, but then it wouldn't work. Mm. If I want to make it work, I have to be faithful to something that exists probably in my head, let's face it, but still sort of, so it's not, in a way, I can't go that wrong, if that makes sense, because it's already there in some unformed way.
It sounds like a really freeing way of writing.
It's really, I mean, it's a great job to have. Yeah. I mean, all that freedom, and also writing fiction, you don't have to fact check every 5 minutes, because basically what you write is the truth.
Yeah.
It's a lot, in a way, it's a lot more true than whatever you could write if you write something factual, because it's hard to get everything across.
Yeah.
But telling a fictional story, what you tell is everything. So in a way, it's a, for me, it's something very real.
Yeah.
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 That makes sense. And so this is a translation. How is that process for you? Obviously, you speak incredible English as well. So, I mean, when you're writing it, how does it marry up in the translation for you?
Well, it's a really, again, an enjoyable process. Sorry about it. I seem to be having way too much fun.
You're so joyful about it. It's great.
I've got a lovely translator, Amy Bojang, and we work together quite closely. And I mean, sometimes I write something and I already know Amy's going to have trouble with this, because obviously not everything translates perfectly. Oh. But on the other hand, sometimes there's stuff you can't do in the German, in the original German, and then she'll find something that makes it even more to the point in English. So I think you win some and you lose some. And it's an exciting process, because in a way it gives me a chance to read my own book as a reader, if that makes sense, because it's my story, but it's no longer my words.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah.
And so if I can read, I feel like, oh, this is really good. This is fun. I'm enjoying this. And it's actually my book, but it's, in a way, it's less my book. I don't recognize, because it was a German. By the time I handed the manuscript, I basically could recite it, because obviously I've worked on the text for 1.5 years. I've polished it all up. There's zero surprise in it for me. But reading the English version makes me see more of the story.
Mm. Yeah.
Because the words are new. And it's really interesting. And so far, I have never come to a point where I felt like this is lost forever. And the text really missing something. Sometimes I write something in German and I feel like if this was English, I could have this pun on that pun. And I can't use it right now. It's just a bit annoying. Oh. But at the same time, it helps me maybe to be a bit less cliche, because I got, you know, more options. And even if I can't use them, maybe it helps me to think of something, a third thing that might work. So, yeah, it's all fun and games, really.
That's amazing. Silver lining to everything with it. And I'm just curious, with the character names, for example, do they stay the same across the translation, or do you change them slightly?
They usually do, unless there would be a very special case of, you know, something. I know that, for example, the my first book, Three Bags Full, the original German title was Glenkill.
Yes.
Which is just the place name. And the English publisher at the time felt that it was a bit too much just a place.
Mm. Right.
And they wanted to add the sheep element, which is why they came up with Three Bags Full. So, obviously, in the book, the place is still called Glenkill, but that was an example for something that changed, because there's a different perception. But my current stories are set in the UK, so obviously I will choose English names. But at the same time, I try to have names that are fairly easy to pronounce, just because obviously German readers will come across them, and it's easier if they've got a sound in their head they can sort of easily imagine, rather than something, you know, it's that weird name that I always skim over because I can't really picture what it's supposed to be. So I try to be recognizable for the German reader, but at the same time faithful to the English setting.
Mm. I'm getting ahead of yourself slightly here, because I appreciate you literally finished the current manuscript today.
Yes. But
do you, for your next book, do you think you'll stick with it set in the UK, or go back to Germany, or somewhere else?
I don't know. I mean, somewhere else is always an option.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons why I write is that it gives you a chance to explore things that you wouldn't have come across otherwise. It's one of the reasons why I read as well. Mm. I mean, there's just, I mean, one of the main attractions for me is that you immerse yourself in somebody else's life and somebody else's in another setting, another situation. It's basically it's a holiday, it's an adventure. But you and writing is in a way is the same. It's also an adventure, and I choose my subject in a way that that gives me opportunity to explore something I haven't explored so far. So it will. That doesn't mean that everything has to be from scratch. I mean, in case of the Argon Sharp books, I have a little trilogy because I felt like I really like the characters and I want to explore them a bit more. Yeah, now I think I'm ready for something new, and it might be actually something really new. I'm not a person who sort of likes to stick with a series for, I don't know, 10, 15 books because I think I'm too curious about other stuff for that. And so pasture's new, probably not sheep.
Nice.
And,
never know.
Yeah, it's just very early, so you can see me sort of.
I know, that was a bit unfair.
No, it's okay. I have to start thinking about it soon, but it'll definitely be something new and hopefully exciting, at least for me.
I'm sure. Yes. Absolutely. And the elderly. Is this something we're starting to see a lot more positive representation, I would say, of elderly people in cozy crime? With obviously Richard Osman's books, your lovely Agnes Sharp series. What inspired that kind of setting for you, and also to represent older people in this way?
Well, as I said, I was looking for somebody who would really be ill-equipped to to tackle a criminal case, because I mean, I think all my protagonists, I mean, all the books I write are some variation of a crime novel, and all my investigators are incompetent. I mean, some to the point of being sheep, which obviously doesn't really help.
A little bashful.
Yeah, there's other people who struggle with other problems, but they're not your ideal investigator, which makes it interesting for me. And I felt that the elderly are a group that, you know, doesn't really get too much attention, at least at the time when I was writing it. Richard Osman, I think, published half a year after I published the original German one, which means that at the time, I thought it was an exciting new idea. I know this has changed a bit now, but I'm still grateful because obviously he's trailblazing in terms of, you know, the acceptance, because a lot of people enjoyed this book and hopefully they go looking for other stuff with elderly protagonists, at which point I come in if I'm lucky. But the idea was to find somebody who gives it a new angle, because a lot about my work is finding, so exploring point of view, and exploring point of view that is not the typical one. So in a way, enhancing the reader's experience a little and just seeing the world from a new angle. In an extreme case, it would be a sheep angle. But I was also quite curious about, because old age is something that comes towards us all if we're lucky. Mm. And I mean, that's the best case scenario. You get old, right? Worst case scenario, you don't get old. So it's something that's somewhere on the horizon. And I feel that people sort of push it away a lot, understandably so, but it probably doesn't do anything to help with the fear, because obviously a lot of people are worried about old age, and again, understandably so, because it's not a picnic. But I felt, in a way, it probably was a way for me to take away a bit of that fear, just by sort of imagining myself in that position and seeing how you could still have fun and still achieve things and still have your goals and your dreams, and maybe even find the odd killer or two if you're lucky, and if you're in a character in a book. So
yeah. I also, I'm sorry, I just can't resist the pun opportunity of you said points of you. I think for sheep, you points of view.
Yeah, I know. Once you go down the sheep route, it's just endless.
It's a very rich field to pick from.
I know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also as well, the older investigator, I mean, you think about Marple, she's pretty old, and others like that. I guess also there's a wisdom that comes with age that helps you see things in a different way to perhaps like a young upstarting PC or whatever.
A certain, I don't know, maybe detachment. You've just experienced a lot of life already and might see things that somebody a bit closer does not see. On the other hand, I think it also can be a bit of a superpower, because everybody chronically underestimates you.
Yes.
You just, the old lady in the corner, I mean, obviously the whole Miss Marple thing is very much some old lady everyone ignores, and she works it all out. And my heroes also benefit from this point, because they don't there's no red flags. It's just a granny in a corner. They can basically do anything.
Yeah.
And worst case scenario, they can pretend they're confused and they get away with absolutely everything. Yeah. So that helps.
That's so true. There is so much. I think you can either get away with things when you're really young or really old, like the middle bit, you kind of have a bit more kind of accountable or responsible for yourself. But please look forward to anyway, as you say.
Yeah. So looking forward to that bit.
Yes. Let's talk more about Agnes, because she is a formidable character.
Oh, yes.
I would love to be Agnes as I age, or even now, actually, just from this age. But
I'd go and live at Sunset Hall now.
Let's not get ahead of
ourselves. Well, you know, you're right. But is there a lot of you in Agnes, or is it more of an aspirational character for you?
It's hard to say. I think there's no one-to-one translation in any case. A lot of people have ask me, sort of, is there anything of me in that book? And it's usually a bit worried. Sort of, I hope it's not. And
if
I never translate characters. They just sort of appear, but obviously they are sort of taken out of a certain soup or mixture, which I have. So she's definitely not me, but obviously there's observations in there. I think she might be a bit inspired by my grandmothers, who were both rather fierce and just really strong characters, I suppose, both in their own way. And obviously there's the odd world view, which might be mine. but it's also just an exploration of I got these few building stones to work with, and I just send her into a situation and see what happens. And it's not me. It's not something I want to be, but it's someone I approve of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to be Agnes.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be Hetty.
I was going to say, I want to be Hetty as well.
She's the most cherished and loved creation in the whole book.
Absolutely. And anthropomorphism seems to be your thing, like with the sheep now, obviously solving the murders, and you've got Hetty and and Brexit representation. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you love animals. I can tell that from your Instagram.
I do, yes.
Like, you were very passionate.
Yeah.
They add such a richness to your stories.
I think for me, it's really intriguing because they are like us in a lot of aspects, and they're very different from us in other aspects.
Yeah.
And as a writer, I just want to get in there and I want to sort of imagine how it is like, what's like to be a tortoise or a sheep. And obviously, it's anthropomorphism. It has to be, because otherwise the human reader would struggle and the sheep reader would be bored because they're only interested in grass, and same with tortoises. So it is written by humans for humans, but I try to get a bit of that strangeness and that sort of just very, very different angle into the story, because it really, in a way, if you look at an investigator, that'll always be a kind of outsider to the story, somebody who sort of looks at a situation or a murder and looks at it from the outside and tries to piece things together. In a way, an animal is even a more extreme case of being an outsider. They look at it from basically from a different world, and then look at us and the humans and what they do. And they might be intrigued. Obviously, the rest is my interpretation in this case. Mm-hmm. But having that gaze, I find, really adds things to my stories, and especially crime stories, because you already got this constellation going that, somebody looking in from the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's obviously a lot of really great lines in your books, but one of our newest questions that Frankie came up with recently was, what's one line that you've written that you are especially proud of, for whatever reason?
It's sort of hard to say. I don't think about lines when I write, funny that it sounds, because it's all about the story. And if I think too much about sounding great, I might have this wonderful description, but it might actually not be the best way to serve a story. Mm. So while I write, whether it's a good line or not doesn't really come into it. However, looking back, I think the very first line of the Three Bags Full, which I think is, "He was healthy yesterday," said Maud. Her ears twitched nervously. That's the first line, and I think it's quite a good way to start the book.
Oh, Maud.
So looking back, I'm rather happy with that. But again, it's not really the way I think.
It's about the bigger picture.
Yes,
not the
it's
teeny about moments.
The reality on the other side of the veil.
I do love a good opening line, though.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, obviously, you want to attract somebody and pull them in and capture them. So, it is important.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that you also read for kind of escapism.
Yes, definitely.
What's the last book that you read and absolutely loved?
Well, I wasn't supposed to read anything, you know yeah. finishing the manuscript. So it's been a while that I read a proper book, but I found ways of cheating on myself, as I usually do. So I've been listening to Holly as an audiobook, Stephen King's new book.
Oh,
I'm not
great.
Through yet. So that's it just, you know, the cheating bit of it's not really a book if you listen to it, right?
Yeah.
And the other way of cheating was web novels, which is a completely new thing. But if you read on a screen, I mean, a new thing for me, so I've never really thought about it. But if you read on a screen, it's not really a book either. So I came across this thing. Okay, now we're into Chinese pronunciation. This is where I go horribly wrong. It's
you're in good company here.
Mo Shang Tong Xiu.
Sure.
You sounded professional.
Sounded great.
Anyway, it's a Chinese web novel. Obviously, I read the translation, and it's called The Scam Villain Self-Serving System. And it's basically a parody of a cliche fantasy hero novel. You've got this hero, you know, this half demon who kills people and has this huge harem. And so that is the fiction. And then the story is one of the critics of that web novel gets sort of sucked into it. And finds himself as a character, and he finds himself as a villain character of the book. And then there he is and tries to save himself because he knows if he doesn't do anything, he's going to be killed by the hero very soon. And it's just so fun. I mean, it's sort of very strange in place. It's a bit like a computer game, but a lot of imagination, very inventive, gets very pornographic towards the end as well.
Oh,
which,
wow, okay.
You know, you can't do it when you're on your web, yep. You know. So, but just really the fun and the playfulness of it really, quite surprised me. It was good.
I like your loopholes that you find for reading things. That's pretty smart.
That was me tricking myself. There you go.
Well, you've still completed your manuscript, so it's not derailed you. You've done it.
Yeah, it worked. And as long as it works, it's okay. But you never know whether it's going to work while you are stuck in the middle. So you have to try to get a bit of discipline.
Yeah. Do you have something that you have been saving to read once you've finished? You're like, oh, I'm going to get to you when I'm done.
I've got a whole pile, really.
Yeah.
But nothing that's stands out as such. So
plenty of time to think about
it. At the
it.
Moment, I'm reading quite a lot of fantasy things. Mm. Just probably escapism again. There you can't go too deep into reality at the moment.
Yeah,
but it's a genre I always enjoy just because there's a lot of freedom in it, and you know.
Yeah. I was going to say, you obviously in the crime world, do you read a lot of crime fiction as well, or do you try to steer clear when you're trying to relax?
I mean, I read it. I don't really think in genres too much, really. Either it's a good story or it's not. I think crime fiction is a great foil because basically you can tell any story as long as there's also a crime in it. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, crime is never really just about the crime. It's about the people that surround it, and it's about working out what their relationships are and working out what the mechanism behind the whole thing is.
Yeah.
So you can do a lot. And I enjoy crime novels, no question about it. But it's not, I don't go out and say it has to be a crime novel. It's just if I want to read something that I find appealing, and probably the book cover comes in again. So there's a fair chance that I get attracted by a nice book cover as well. So I just, it's a hedonistic approach, I suppose.
No, it's good. Why not? Is it time, Sarah? You're looking at me, I think.
It's time.
Oh, it's a shame because it's been so lovely chatting to you, Leonie. But unfortunately,
it's been great fun.
It has, but I've got some bad news to deliver to you now. And actually, it's a little bit of a confrontation because you've committed a terrible, heinous crime, Leonie.
Gosh, that's bad news.
Isn't it? I know. Yeah. It really is bad news because not only have you committed that crime and then subsequently been caught for it, unfortunately,
that's even worse.
It gets worse.
Thank God I'm sitting already.
I know. And even worse than that, not only were you caught and you have been charged with the crime, you've also been sentenced to death.
Mm.
Eek.
That's a bit of a shame.
A bit of a downer, not great.
Drat.
Sorry about that. But I am curious, what crime have you committed, do you think, to warrant this?
Well, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, that's fair.
That is fair. We've had some very interesting answers to that question. Some people go straight to confessing to murder. Others have said very weird abstract rhymes. I don't know. But you're pleading the fifth, as the Americans say on this.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. I mean,
smart.
Surely it's not my job to figure it out. I've already done the crime. I don't have to solve it as well.
Very, very fair point. But you are, and you're not even really doing the time because, I mean, arguably it's the end of your time because, unfortunately, as we said, death row. But it's not all bad news.
Which country are we in again?
We're in a fictional world, as you said. You don't have to be too accurate. We're in an abstract world.
Oh, it's all used against me now, is it?
Yes, well, that's what a good lawyer does, isn't it? They flip their words and, you know. But not all bad news, because before you are sent to death, we're going to give you the death row meal of your dreams. So, silver lining.
That's really great news. What's all worth it then? Who says a crime doesn't pay?
Exactly. Really worth it in the end. But what would your death row meal be?
Well, I have to admit, if I'm really nervous, and I suspect I will be a bit nervous when the time comes, I don't really have that much of an appetite, but obviously I would try my best. And
very, very brave.
Let's say some fritter misto, some nice wreath of, you know, these sort of seafood things that they fry in a very light batter with a
calamari.
Bit of sea salt and lemon. Yes, that kind of stuff in a little cone. Ideally by the seaside, but I suppose I can't choose the location.
Well.
Start with that. Then maybe a black risotto, a Venetian one, very dark. It will set the tone for things to come. And then something really nice, chocolatey for my nerves.
Nice. Death by chocolate. I love it. Yeah.
Well, and ideally I keel over before the actual execution happens. That'd be the best case scenario.
That is, yeah. Oh, well, that is a good menu. I like the specification of the cone for the calamari. Delicious. Good choices. And any drinks to go with that?
I'm not really much of an alcohol person, so.
That's okay. Any fluid will do.
Grapefruit juice.
I love grapefruit,
but maybe not with the meal, maybe before or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
And a nice tea afterwards to
lovely
round things off. Well, that wasn't so bad. See,
there you go.
You've had a great meal. And there's further good news for you. I mean, unfortunately, the worst has happened.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. But we're going to bury you with the book of your choice. What book are you taking with you?
Lovely. It's like Desert Island. Under 3 feet under, 6 feet under.
However far we want to dig, we can go either length, either depth.
Yeah. Well, I thought a bit about this question. I thought, in what scenario would I actually need a book in my coffin? I think I can think of two things. One is I want to impress a grave robber with my literary prowess.
Yeah.
In that case, I'd probably go for something like Shakespeare's complete works, and there'd also be a nice little headrest, I believe.
Yes.
And then the other thing would be if I'm buried alive and somebody had the foresight to add flashlight to my coffin, and then I wake up and I've got some reading material, and I think in that case I want something that is really engaging to distract me from my dire situation.
Yeah.
A lot of suspense, but not too dark, something uplifting at the same time, and most importantly, not too long, because it would really, really, really be a downer if I die before I finish the book, especially if it's intriguing and full of suspense. So, yeah. In fact, it might actually be a nice little, you know, maybe short story or something like that. If you're the author and you've got this critic you really don't like, and you sort of lock him in a coffin with your book and a flashlight, see whether he likes it
or
not.
Brilliant. But do you have a book in mind?
No, not really. I mean, the crucial thing is that I don't know the book yet, obviously. Otherwise, it wouldn't be as engaging.
I see.
I suppose.
We'll pick something from the prison library and pop it in there, and we'll make sure there's a reading light fitted.
Maybe not for a prison library. It's probably all about think positive, how you better yourself.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Which is a bit late for that.
Yeah,
we'll go to a nice little bookshop, find a really good book of short stories. Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Deal. Okay. But either way, we'll make sure there's a reading light.
I can't say
in.
I particularly look forward to it.
No.
I mean, I hope it doesn't happen.
I mean, the lesson, I suppose, is just don't. I was going to say don't commit the crime, but more to the point, don't get caught.
Don't get caught.
Exactly.
Yes.
Perfect. Oh, well, Leonie, it's been so wonderful to chat to you and to talk about your brilliant book, which is out now everywhere, isn't it?
It is out, yes.
Fantastic.
Out and available in the wild.
In the wild, in the field somewhere. No, that's the first book. This one, we're in a care home. Where can people follow you online to see more of your great photos of animals?
Well, I'm only on Instagram just because well, no, Facebook stressed me out, and Twitter again is I quite enjoy not having to do too much with words when I'm not actually working. So I quite enjoy photography, as you said, and so it gives me a nice little excuse to get my camera out and take pictures. So I'm on Instagram, and it's lower sort of _ Leonie Swan, one word, and on Instagram. And yeah, there's loads of dog pictures, be warned. But
perfect.
Yeah.
Incentive. Lots of dogs, lots of sheep. Yeah. Enjoy the sheep as well.
Other creatures.
Yes.
There's not a lot of me as a, you know, the mug shots, which is another relief, I suppose. And you see your occasional book as well.
Fantastic. And Sarah, where can people follow us online?
They can find us at Red and Buried Podcast on all the social medias, I believe, or you can email us at redandburiedpodcast@gmail.com.
That is correct. Wow. Yes. Well, thank you again, Leonie. It's been so lovely to chat to you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great fun.
Oh, we're excited for the next book in the series now. Wait for that.
Yes, coming out next September, I believe.
Brilliant.
There you go.
Fantastic. And I can't wait to see the cover design. I have to say, I am someone who is a huge, huge fan of my Kindle, but I really recommend buying this one, hard copy, because it is beautiful.
Gorgeous. It's worth it for the tortoise alone.
Exactly. I mean, to be honest, who needs the actual content of the book? Oh, you wanted it. Let's torture
it. It's a good
get
tortoise.
Get it on the bookshelf.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much again, Leonie. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon with another episode. Leonie, we never know how to end this podcast. How do we do it? What should we say?
Well, you just say bye, I suppose. That's a good old classical way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye.
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 How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while revelling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule wherever you get your podcasts.